you've worked with were often start from that point.
Yes. So the Prime Minister might say something, then the opposition leader might respond, and you already had very early in the day the story.
How would you describe the working conditions here?
I had quite a good office, Rob Chalmers' office, because he'd been one of the, you know, been in the gallery for 40 or 50 years even then. He had a great big office, whereas once I moved to 2GB, we had a tiny broom cupboard with room just for two people, even though we had three in it. So it was very crowded. There was no room to install equipment. There was no room for anybody else to join the gallery. If you were a new news organisation, there was just simply not the space for you to join. So it was very restrictive in that. There was no competition. People who already had offices had a huge advantage over anybody else who wanted to come to Canberra and report politics. So as a result of 2CH, for example, they had to get into Rob's office and presumably pay him rent, or, you know, so he had that advantage that he could do that. The advantage, of course, was everybody was living on top of each other, so you always found out about things that were happening. You would literally bump into politicians as you walked through the building. People would stop and talk all the time. So things, there was a very constant flow of information. The offices the politicians had were very tiny, so people didn't spend a lot of time in them. They were often walking the corridors or going anywhere. So you were amongst each other. The Fairfax people had demountables placed on the roof, which have now been demolished. And to get to them, you had to walk through an exposed walkway across the roof. So in winter, that was freezing. It was, you could walk through, it had a roof on it, but you would walk to get from our office to the chamber. We had to walk through those walkways, and it was, you know, winter. It was absolutely freezing, and it might be raining, and water would pour into the offices, and the building leaked badly, and all sorts of issues. Particularly television had to build, you know, tiny little things in the corner with cameras, and so there was no room for anybody to do anything other than the basics. But radio is basic. It's a telephone and a tape recorder, so I didn't need a lot of room. It was fine for me.
What about sort of working hours would you have? I mean, from what you, it sounded like most of your stories will happen during the day.
Yes.
And they've at night time, you, in a sense, the radio news stops.
I was supposed to have a regular 8-hour shift, but if things were happening, you'd be here 10, 12, 14 hours. That was expected, that if, you know, a big story broke, you would stay on. But so when I first started here, I worked from about 6 in the morning till 2 or 3 in the afternoon. Radio is that. Most people listen to radio in the morning, breakfast radio. About, you know, 50 to 75% of everybody who ever listens to radio listens at breakfast. So that's when you want your best stories and all your staff on later in the day. But if a challenge happened or a big story broke, I'd still be there at 5 or 6 o'clock. But I didn't mind that. I loved the job. I love politics. And if there was a big political event happening, I wanted to be there. I didn't have to be told. That was just something I enjoyed doing myself.
So work would not have impacted too much on your social life?
Not when I first came here, because I was on my own. My family was all in Sydney. I didn't know many people, so I'd go back to Sydney virtually every weekend to see people. So, you know, if I went home, I'd be going home to nothing. I wasn't sharing with anybody, so it didn't bother me at all. I wasn't not seeing people, because that was all I did, was work down here and then go home on the weekend if I could.
What parts of the building did you use?
So we were in the... Our part of the press gallery was on the Senate side. So we had the offices of 2GB Macquarie inside Canberra, which is where I was based initially. 2WS was in Mungo McCallum's office. So what the radio area was all a very tight little area. So Macquarie had a little booth. 2WS was in Mungo McCallum's office. 2CH was in Rob Chalmers' office. And 2UE was there too, next to 2GB. They had a slightly bigger office. But also there was the afternoon papers. The Sydney Sun, I think, was just next door to them. And the National Times had an office there. Sally Lone and a few people there were in the National Times office. And then just round the corner from us, I think, was SBS and possibly Channel 10. So we were all in that section on what was the top floor of the Senate wing. And we could just turn around the corner and there was the Senate Press Gallery. It was right next to the entrance to the Senate Press Gallery.
So did you attend many sessions in the chambers, or did most of your work go by based on interviews? And
no, we went to question time.
Right.
But you could listen to that in the office. There was no television broadcasting then. There were no TV was allowed. You weren't allowed to film in the chambers. And we were allowed to listen to question time on speakers in our office and record it, but we were not allowed to play the tape on the radio. You were not allowed to run the audio, I think, at that stage. Maybe that had just been changed. You have to check on the rules of that. But there had been some, maybe we were allowed to play the tape then. But certainly there was no television pictures. So you could go and watch, but usually if you're working in radio, it'd be better to stay in the office, listen to it, because something might happen at 2:30 and then you've got to get that on the 3 o'clock news. Mm. And it always would, question time, there'd always something that happened. So it would be better to stay in the office and listen. So you're often stuck to the desk listening and reporting for, and nothing's changed. I still rarely go into the parliament ever. I still watch it now on the television and still play it all, because now we're on air all the time.
What about what kind of equipment did you use for your job?
Initially, I had a thing called a Superscope cassette recorder. It was quite big, took 4 D-sized batteries, was quite heavy, but it was took very good quality, but it just used standard tape cassettes. Then we moved to another one, which is called a Sony, which was also used tape cassettes, but was a lot smaller, a lot lighter, and only used little B-sized or C-sized batteries. And we just had a microphone very much like these, which just plugged in to the front of them. So you just carried it, had a shoulder strap, just cassettes, and then you would play back the cassette to the point you wanted and use the pause button. So when I had the telephone, you would literally line up the bit you wanted, hit pause, and then you would hold the telephone over the speaker, lift the pause button until the bit finished, and then press the pause button down. And that was how they got the audio. Later on, we had lines, so we could plug a line in, but we still used that. When I moved to 2GB, they had reel-to-reel tape recorders. We still recorded our interviews on cassette, but we could then edit using reel-to-reel tape recorders, so we could dub from one to the other to get the bit we needed. Mm. The ABC at that time used Nagras, the very expensive portable reel-to-reel recorders, which had very high quality and very low background hiss, which is what they liked about them. And they would edit by literally using razor blades to cut the bits of tape that they wanted, and then stick the bits of tape together with sticky tape and then play the final piece. So they would record voice pieces and label them, and then you would stick it all together in a great long line of sticky tape bits with numbers, and then you would put the whole thing back on the reel-to-reel and then play it. And that was how they did it. Whereas we just used the pause button to dub from one to another. And so when I arrived, I had a typewriter in the corner and a telephone and a little tape recorder, and I just typed my stories up on scrap paper, read them over the telephone, and somebody in Sydney would record them and write the leads up again that the newsreader would read, and record my stories onto cartridges, which were played in a cartridge machine. Later, when I got the... And then I had to ring Sydney and then Melbourne and then Perth and do the whole thing each time. I had to do it 3 times, because they had no... And then later they got a line between them, so I could ring Sydney and Sydney could patch it down the line to Melbourne and Perth. And then I got the line, which meant eventually I could just press a button and talk to Sydney, Melbourne and Perth and do it once in high quality down a 10K landline, which, you know, sounds like we are talking now. And then I got a computer with a 14K dial-up modem, which... I thought was the best thing I'd ever seen. And what it did was, it you could type the story on the computer and send it, but it, for example, when it opened a story, it opened the story by reading each word, one word at a time would appear on your screen. It was that slow that it took perhaps 2 minutes to actually open a simple story on your screen. But for me, that was the most wonderful thing I'd seen, because I could now type on the screen, edit, then transmit that, and I wouldn't have to ring them and read it to them. They now had it. So it sped things up. We went from... I used to have to file no later than about 10 minutes to the hour, because I had to read the story to Sydney and Melbourne and Perth. They all had to get it in time. But once I got the computer and the line, I could be ringing at 1 or 2 minutes to the hour and say, this has just happened, quick, you know, here's a big story. And so it crunched the... it made things a lot quicker and a lot better quality. And that was just starting to happen about then. I think a lot of that sort of equipment was just starting to come into newsrooms.
Yeah, in the 1980s, yes.
The 70s, late 70s was the first newsroom computers, but they were still only just for newspapers to just do very simple systems, and there was, of course, no internet connection. It didn't exist. So if you wanted a story All the newspapers employed large numbers of people whose sole job was to cut pieces out of newspapers and put them in vast files labelled as Hawke or Howard or Jobs or Defence or whatever. And they were huge. Every newspaper office had massive files of clips, as they were called. And so for your research, if you wanted to find an old story, would be to wade through. It might take you days to find what you're looking before you did the story. Whereas now, of course, I can find it on the internet in 10 seconds.
Did you have much interaction with staff at LPH?
A bit, yeah, mainly press secretaries. So they were still similar today. There were lists of people who were the press secretaries for various ministers and shadow ministers, and you would ring them and they would answer your questions and put their minister or shadow minister up for an interview or give comment on their behalf. There were other staff you saw, but it was generally... The thing about where I worked, 2CH was regarded almost as the bottom of the rung. The big correspondents were still, you know, Laurie Oakes, and the big TV reporters were still the stars, and the big newspaper reporters like Michelle Grattan and you know, Mike Steckety and people like that were the stars. And then other newspaper reporters might be taken seriously if they were the defence reporter or the health reporter. But by the time you got down to radio, people didn't take us very seriously. If they did, it might be 2GB. By the time we got to a little music station at 2CH, I remember ringing the Prime Minister's Press Secretary once, Jeff Walsh, who I later worked with, and he was starting to answer my question. And then he said, "Who are you again?" And I told him, and he said, "Why am I even talking to you?" And he hung up. So he thought, as the Prime Minister's Press Secretary, he didn't even need to talk to somebody at a little radio station. So there was that, you know, there was that frustration that you were aware that people were being told things and people would know stuff, and there was, they would not tell you because they didn't think you were important. So you did the best you could, which was sometimes you heard things, sometimes you started to make contacts and friends and they might tell you things. But it was always, it's still the case today, that, you know, if the government wants a big story, we'll give it to a favoured reporter in a newspaper and the rest of you can read it the next day.
Did you have much contact with your colleagues after work?
A little bit. The radio people all tended to be very close because we went to all the same things, so you would always be radio there in the morning on the front steps. I didn't get very much involved in the sort of the social life, just because that's not me. I'm not the sort of person who goes to clubs and things like that. But there were people who would often go to the press club, who would go to it. Often it was more each other's houses in those days. You know, we would get together for dinner on a Friday or Saturday night at my house or their house or other people's houses and bring a bottle and all to take away food. And it was often the radio journalists. I'd had very little to do with other journalists, but the 2UE, 2GB, 2WS, 2CH, we spent a lot of time together at lunch or dinner or...
Did you use the parliamentary non-members dining room?
I went to the staff cafeteria. I'd go there for lunch most days because there's nothing else then around here. There was nowhere else to eat. There was no place, you know, nearest place would have been Kingston or Civic. So if you didn't bring your own lunch, you needed to drive a fair distance to get to another place to eat. You know, the High Court and the library and all of those didn't have anything in those days. But I didn't go there for... I'd go there for dinner if I was on a late shift, but I wouldn't go there for dinner. If I was stuck in the building working, and I would perhaps go and grab something. But I wouldn't stay there because you don't really get meal breaks. You'd have to grab a takeaway and take it back to the office and eat it in the office.
So would it be fair to say that the radio people, like yourself, you kept, in a sense, separate from the television and the...
To the most part, yes. We were all quite young too. Most of us were quite young, of a similar age. We'd all come down from Sydney or Melbourne for a couple of years. So we were all a bit sort of left behind, our families and friends, and we're always going home to Sydney or Melbourne every couple of weekends. So none of them really became good friends, but we were just all doing a similar job. We all worked right next to each other. All our offices were right together on top of each other. And we would often help each other out. You know, if your tape recorder had broken or you'd not been able to get to a press conference, or perhaps you had to go on air and do a report, you might say to the other one, "Oh, can you get that for me?" And they would, because you would then do that for them. So there was a lot of helping out. You wouldn't give them your big story. If you had a big lead story, you wouldn't do that if you got something on your own. But you were always helping them out with... Cassettes were always getting stuck and jammed and being destroyed in the machines. you get back from a press conference and discover the cassette had wrapped itself around the machine and you had nothing. So in which case, the other person would lend you their cassette and you would use that. And that happened all the time. So there was that sort of encouragement and support. And I think we just, because we all realised we were not regarded as that serious by, you know, newspapers and TV came first, so we sort of looked after each other to a certain extent. But the social life, to the extent it was going around to people's houses and having dinner.
Right.
But all together, 10, 12 of us.
But you at least had one big occasion when you went to a party, the 1988 final party. Can you tell us about the what from your perspective, what happened and what was it all, what was it like?
Well, they had the sort of the ceremonial final sitting. Well, actually, no, it was a regular sitting of Parliament that night. And I think Leo McClay was he was in the chair. I think he might have been acting speaker or something, but he was in the chair. And because it was the final, everybody in the press gallery uniquely all went into the press gallery. We all actually packed the press gallery to watch the final few minutes. And somebody started seeing where people were wearing very bright, weird ties. I think it was Andrew Butcher, who later went on to work for News Limited and also became, you know, Rupert Murdoch's chief public relations person. He's now back in Australia, but he was a young cadet then. So everybody was wearing very bizarre ties, just as a bit of a joke. And one of the politicians made a joke about it, said, you know, Mr. Speaker, I draw your attention to the state of the press gallery. You know, they use that phrase, I draw your attention to the state of the chamber, which means I'm calling a quorum. But he, and as Leo McClay was trying to, if it was him or whoever was in the chair, was trying to wrap it up, people kept moving points of order in the hope they'd be the last person to record it. And then he pointed out that no matter what happened, the very last person to speak would be the person in the chair, because he would have to declare proceedings over. And so that stopped them. But people would, as a joke, jumping up and constantly trying to make funny points of order just so they could get themselves in hands up. And finally, it was all over. And the second it was all over, people spilled out of the galleries into the corridors and parties just started erupting. There was no set party that I could see. People were just having drinks in rooms, in corridors, singing, dancing. I was in one of the committee rooms where I think the Labour Party had organised something and people were standing around talking, and it was quite nice. And Bob Hawke came along and he was talking. But then Bob Hawke heard that there had been a proper party had broken out in one of the corridors, and he was determined to go to that party. And his press secretary at the time, Barry Cassidy, was terrified, because Hawke, of course, didn't drink because he was now off the booze. And Barry, I think, was worried that if Hawke went along to this, that either he might drink or that it might become, you know, might not look good. And he tried to physically stop Hawke from going, and Hawke pushed him. I saw him push Barry out of the way to say, I'm going, even though Barry tried to restrain him. And he took off, so we all followed. The whole room just went, because we thought, the Prime Minister's going to this, it must be good. And when we got there, it was Labour people outside the Reps chamber in the corridor, had literally spilled straight out of the chamber into the corridor and were drinking in the corridors, were singing, were telling jokes. There was just this huge party erupted. And then Hawke decided he would sing, and he sang, I'm trying to remember what he sang. I think they might have done Waltzing Matilda, and he might have done Solidarity Forever. He wasn't a very good singer, but he had a big, loud, deep voice, and it was the Prime Minister, so people were happy and applauded. Then suddenly John Howard appeared in the middle of this, who was then the opposition leader. He sort of barged his way into it, and he was clearly very drunk. He was extremely drunk. And he staggered into the middle of this, and there was a bit of quiet because Labour people, I think, were a bit worried, not offended, not didn't quite know what to make of this. But Howard then started singing a song which is to the tune of Solidarity Forever, but it's a send-up song about Santa Maria destroying the Labour Party. And he was, Santa Maria, Labour must have solidarity. And it brought the house down, you know, even though it was an anti-Labour song. In fact, John Howard was drunk and was singing it. Made everybody cheer him. And then Hawke stepped in, put his arm through John Howard's arm, and the two of them then sang together. And that might have been Waltzing Matilda, or maybe even the real version of Solidarity Forever. But so Howard, who was then the opposition leader, and Hawke, who was the Prime Minister, linked arms, and in amongst a whole bunch of Labour MPs and half the press gallery, started singing together in the corridors. And journalists who were there knew that the rules were we were never allowed to record anything in the corridors, but people realised this was such a massive event that something had to be done. and people had raced off to get tape recorders. And there were at least two radio journalists, Tony Allen, who I worked with the 2GB, and Annie McCaig, who then worked for 2WS, who recorded it. Tony, I think, hid his off to one side. Annie, I think, just stuck her tape recorder in a jacket and hid their microphones like this. And the sergeant at arms was looking around frantically, was obviously worried this would be recorded by the journalists, and was trying to watch anything. A TV cameraman from the ABC, Adrian, whose last name I can't remember, put a TV camera on the stairs and filmed through the railings, sort of like a hidden camera shot almost. And the sergeant spotted that, and I think at the end of the night she went up to him and she told him that she was confiscating the tape and she took it. But it's, I believe it has been given to the National Library with a 20 or 30 year embargo on it. So I'm pretty sure the tape exists. Vision. Now, the Vision has never been seen. I'm not aware the Vision has ever been shown anywhere ever, because I think the one and only recording was confiscated that night. But the audio of Hawke and Howard singing was played on the radio the next morning by 2GB and by, I'm pretty sure, 2EWS. So it was 2WS. It was run that morning. And the cassettes again later handed over to but there was a very extensive, and I'm fairly sure I can find that, but but it was an extraordinary thing to see. Amazing night. Everybody really did totally let their hair down, bipartisan. It was just, people were celebrating the fact that it was the end of the old Parliament House. The parties went till 3, 4, 5, I don't know. I mean, I think I left about 3 or 4 and it was still going, and everybody was there were things happened. I think somebody kidnapped John Kerr's portrait from, fairly certain that was a guy called Peter Logue. It was later returned, but some of them sort of drunkenly broke into, and sort of lefty types stole John Kerr's painting and hid that somewhere for a while. I'm not sure any real damage was done, but there was more sort of mischief that was going on, the corridors like that, and people going back to various offices. But then, you know, you didn't have camera phones. People didn't carry cameras around all the time. So the only people who had cameras were just the professionals, and so they had to be very careful because they were aware that they weren't supposed to be shooting it, but people were also doing what they could to take those photos.
So a good time was had by all?
Absolutely. It was a fantastic... I mean, it's not the sort of... You know, I've never been part of the parliamentary sort of late-night drinking scene, but that was just an extraordinary thing to see the Prime Minister standing in the corridor singing their songs and then linking arms with a very, very drunk John Howard belting out, I think it was Waltzing Matilda together, but the two of them sort of singing together. And it was a fantastic thing to witness. As it turns out, it wasn't the very end session. They came back some weeks later for a what-off special final sitting of Old Parliament House. I think it might have been in August or something. So they actually did have a special ceremonial farewell sitting during the daytime, which was very proper and very, you know, full formal, with just people making formal speeches. But the actual final real sitting was the one where, and it literally, it was about 10:30, 11 o'clock at night at the rising of the Parliament. They just literally fell into the corridors, out of the doors of the chambers, and then just people didn't move. That was where the party was.
Well, that's, I wondered about a couple of more
yeah, sure, we've got plenty
aspects
of time.
About the time at Old Parliament House. Did you have much contact with parliamentarians generally?
I did. Again, Well, I mean, we saw, as I said, we saw the Prime Minister and the Opposition Leader and the Treasurer and pretty much anybody we wanted every morning on the front steps. They were just turned up and spoke to us. It was extraordinary access, probably never, certainly hasn't happened since, and probably never happened at any other parliament in the world, that the Prime Minister would step out of a car, walk onto the steps and speak to you every morning about whatever you wanted. And that was the thing they changed when they moved to New Parliament House. The Press Secretary shut that down because they wanted to take the control away from the journalists.
But you could say the journalists, as you as journalists, had almost control over that.
Yes, you decided what to ask.
They
would step onto the front steps and you could say, Prime Minister, there's a bad opinion poll. Prime Minister, one of your ministers is in trouble. Or Prime Minister, the opposition's in trouble. I mean, some days it'd be good for him, some days it'd be bad. But they couldn't decide, as they do now, it's a bad day, we won't appear. It's a good day, we will appear. Or it's a bad day, let's announce something. They would walk into the cameras and be asked every morning. In John Howard's case, every single morning about a bad opinion poll. You know.
And in your case, it would be the listening to the voice. recording?
Sometimes ask questions. There'd be half a dozen or more of us all throwing the questions, so usually the same question. But I mean, I can remember there, you know, Keating arriving one morning and we asked him some questions, and then he stopped and he said, "Is that it?" And we said, "Yes." And he said, "Right, well, I've got something to say." And that was when he ripped into John Howard over Wilson Tuckey raising questions. And he just said, "I will crucify that man. He will wear his leadership like a crown of thorns." And that wasn't a question. We had thought we shouldn't ask him about that because he had been asked about it previously and he had gone berserk at the journalist. So everybody didn't ask. And then he waited and he just looked. And I remember he just said, "Is that it? Right, well, I've got something to say." And then he just went. And we just, of course, immediately ran back to the offices to play this out. Keating's gone berserk type stuff. Another morning there was people, protesters would occasionally come there because they could see that politicians were there. All sorts of things would happen. So you'd have that. But there were, I remember, very young Alexander Downer, who was just then an MP, not considered very serious at that stage, would often come to my office to record. He was keen to talk to us and record things which would get a run on the radio because he was building his profile. But lots of other... I remember one day, we had a minister on. I think it was Ralph Willis was on in the booth, and John Kerrin came looking for him and just sat in our office waiting to talk because he was bored and he wanted to talk to Ralph Willis and things like that. So people would walk into and through the press gallery all the time because in a sense it was almost impossible to avoid. The building was so small there was nowhere else to go. So you did have that contact. And the famous story is that when the leadership challenge happened between Howard and Peacock in 1989, shortly after we moved to the new building, and no journalist got it, as I said that story before where our person just rang up and found out it had happened, the view was that would never have happened in the old Parliament House because everybody would have seen people coming in and going from various doors and offices, whereas in the new Parliament House, because we're separated, these things could happen without us knowing. And famously, Michelle Grattan had written that day in the paper that there was no leadership challenge, that it was all fallacy and it was never going to happen. And so she was quite badly harmed by that. And there was a prior cartoon which showed Michelle crying and somebody saying, "There, there, Michelle, blame it on the new building." And there was that sense that the new building had been designed for the politicians, whereas the old one, we'd been living on top of them and they couldn't really do much about that, whereas they did in the new one. They separated us to a certain extent.
So could one, in one sense, maybe describe the environment at Old Parliament House as transparent and open?
It was to a large extent, yes. Almost incestuous, some people said, because journalists were very, so close to politicians, perhaps they were too close in some respects, that they became very friendly with them. A lot of journalists were... I was quite surprised when I came here to discover how many journalists on both sides were very, very close friends with a lot of very senior politicians. And again, that was a sense, Canberra, I think, being a small town and not much else to do, that people went out to dinner and developed all sorts of friendships and relationships, which in some cases still endure to this day. There are people who were John Howard's friend in the 70s and 80s who were journalists who were still good friends with him, and others who were very close friends with Bob Hawke, who were still very close friends, but not even journalists. I mean, one of my cameramen is a very close friend of Bob Hawke's and a very close friend of his family, and especially one of his daughters. And that's just because not just journalists, but everybody was on top, particularly on the overseas trips. You'd be on, in those days, we all travelled on the Prime Minister's actual plane, the old 707. So he would be up the front, the staff behind, and the journalists at the back of the plane. Now, when the Prime Minister goes overseas, we fly separately. We don't fly on the Prime Minister's plane. So we try to catch up with wherever the Prime Minister's going. Of course, if you were on an overseas flight to Europe or America, the Prime Minister would come down the back and talk to you and the staff, and you'd all be mingling and in a very, nobody's recording, so it's not a... you'd get a good relationship with them.
When you talk about journalists here, are you including also the radio, those who operate radio?
Yes, to a certain extent, particularly the cameramen. Smart politicians would become very good friends with cameramen, I think, because they realised the cameramen were the people who could do you the most damage. They could run a nasty shot of you looking the wrong way, or they could run a nice picture of you. So good politicians appreciated that while they might find cameramen intrusive, that if you were friendly with the cameraman, you that would help you a lot. And Keating never was friendly with the cameraman. The cameraman always hated him, so they would often... he hated them. He thought they were intrusive and filming stuff he didn't want. And so they still to this day don't like him, whereas they all love Bob Hawke. All the cameramen think Bob Hawke was wonderful because he was very friendly to them and respected them and supported them. So
did you in your role in your company, did you have people who were actually camera operators as well?
No, not then. I was just working in radio, so we were totally self-contained. Every radio journalist carried their own kit.
And
so.
Would you travel overseas?
Yes. I did a number of. I've done many overseas trips with prime ministers, but I did a few with Hawke in those days.
And with the area of responsibility of radio rather than.
Yes, totally as radio. So it was exactly the same job, except I'd be phoning from overseas.
Right.
And again, putting the phone on the tape recorder and playing back the reports and crossing it in the middle of the night or whatever the hour differences were. So.
Are there any politicians that you dealt with in this way or that you particularly admired or respected?
Yeah, I think Keating was the one we all admired or respected because he clearly was somebody who had a very strong drive to achieve something.
Mm.
And when he spoke, he always spoke in a very entertaining, informative fashion. As a journalist, he would always say things that were interesting and newsworthy. So many politicians use language which is designed to hide what they're saying or find it very difficult to say in simple terms what it is they're talking about. Every budget press conference would be entertaining, would be a sparring match, would be fascinating. I just found him. Hawke was a fun bloke up close. I mean, somebody once said, and I think this is right, that at large people liked Hawke, but when you got really close to him, you found him perhaps not that attractive. He was, you know, he was very, had a very high opinion of himself. And he had very close friends who admired him, but others might find him up close not that nice a person. Whereas Keating was the opposite. The public didn't like him, but if you actually got talking to him in a private setting, he was a fascinating character who could speak about anything. Mm. He would tell amazing stories about checking the lodge silverware with Princess Diana, or clocks he'd looked at, or overseas trips he'd been on, or conversations he'd had with foreign leaders. And then at press conferences, he was always entertaining, loud, funny, you know, just made news every time he spoke. And it was so as a reporter, that was fun. You knew if Keating was saying something, you'd have a story. Whereas quite often these days, any politicians, no matter how senior, just seem determined often not to be reported. Hawke was dominant at that point. I mean, another one was fascinating, although, sorry, no, this was the new parliament, this was Hewson. But I mean, Howard was interesting at that time, only in retrospect, in the sense that he was leader, but the whole time, Peacock supporters were undermining him and ring you to tell you openly about how something that Howard had done. You know, his own people were trying to bring him down just as he had done that to Peacock.
Mm.
And so you were constantly aware that the coalition was a mess. They didn't really know what they stood for. They had Joe coming in trying to split the coalition. You had Peacock undermining him. And so Howard was desperately trying to reinvent the Liberal Party, but without, you know, his whole party was falling apart under him. He was at the time, I don't think people sort of, you know, the famous bulletin headline, you know, why does this man bother, you know, with the opinion polls? But I found him a lot more interesting at that time, but I never thought that he would succeed. And I just thought, you know, in a sense, his time had gone. It looked like, you know, you're sort of, and at the stage, you really couldn't see what was coming in the Liberal Party's place that would ever make them a success, because they just seem so bitterly divided, I suppose, in a way the Labour Party's done for years now.
And that would approach these members of Parliament, would they approach you or your colleagues and sort of talk about these things, or is this things that would come about because you were hearing?
Oh, both. I mean, you'd hear about, you ring people, and people who, you know, you knew didn't like John Howard would tell you stuff that would damage him because they were trying to bring him down to get Peacock to be leader. And sometimes people would just openly tell you stuff. I mean, one I remember was Peter Slipper, who was then a National Party MP from Queensland, coming straight out of a coalition meeting and standing in the press gallery and openly telling any journalist who was there how badly he thought John Howard had done. This was when the National Party with Queensland from Joe was trying to split the coalition, and see, he would openly stand there in full public view telling everybody stuff that was damaging about Howard. And I remember sort of walking into this and being quite shocked. I knew it went on, but nobody had done it. But things had got so bad by that stage with the Joe for Canberra campaign that the Queensland Nationals were, you know, almost an open party, just standing there openly denouncing Howard and the Liberal Party and the coalition. And you know, and this was the backdrop that Howard was trying to fight the 87 election on with. You know, he didn't have to fight the Labor Party, he pretty much had to fight his own party. So I remember walking into a room and hearing him bitterly complaining about the coverage of the ABC. And I mean, the 87 election was in theory supposed to be fought about the Australia card. It was a double dissolution election, but nobody ever mentioned it. And Howard was being urged by people to fight against the Australia card, and he was attacking people and saying, I'm sick of people telling me what to do. The Australia card's popular. And as it turns out, it eventually wasn't popular. But and then he was complaining about the ABC and Kerry O'Brien in particular. So even way back then, he sort of had that problem. And with some justification, I think, then, in the fact that, as I said, not because I don't think the gallery's Labour biased or Liberal, but it does tend to run as a pack with a certain view of the world. So if it thinks one side's doing well and one side's not, it runs that way. And it's been running, you know, towards the Liberals for years now because the Labour Party's divided. And at some point, if the Liberal Party looks a mess, it'll probably run. So it does tend to be a herd mentality. And that herd mentality doesn't often see shades of grey. It sees, you know, everything's good and everything's bad. And so Howard got very badly damaged by that, that he nothing he did would be reported in a positive light just because everybody assumed that everything he did was a disaster and he wasn't going to be elected.
Is there anything else you would like to add about your time at Old Parliament House? There are other areas, that are some particular one area.
Yeah, sure.
That would like, if we have time to cover.
Anything else
you'd like to
add? Oh, the one thing I suppose I'd draw, the big thing was the security. I mean, at the Old Parliament House, if you had a pass, you just walked straight in the front door. You never got checked for security. And the public didn't get checked for security. There was no scanners, I don't think. You just walked straight in any time of the day or night. So it was a very open place, lot free. You could walk through any corridor, walk up to any MP's room, knock on the door, walk up to the Prime Minister's press office and knock on the door, that sort of thing. So there was that, plus, as I said, that sense that people were... I mean, there was one famous story where something big happened one night and Michelle Grant was trying to get a quote out of the Treasurer and he refused. So she just sat outside his door and refused to move because it was the only door he could leave from.